listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of the environment, food, and health, policy, science, media, and popular attitudes and understandings. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between each one of us in our individual well-being and all of the things that support that and that we are connected to in our greater world. We talk about our food, water, air, and earth. We talk about the health of ourselves, of our communities, of our healthcare system, of our food system, of our society, and how all of that contributes to our ecological balance, survival, and well-being here on planet Earth. So that's the theme of the show, and each week we talk with different filmmakers, advocates, activists, authors, scientists, policymakers, other journalists, whole musicians, poets, many different people covering all of the different facets that connect us. On today's show, we're returning to a theme that I've been covering all through 2016 into 2017, and that is the indigenous uprising of water protectors at Standing Rock. Even though that the Sacred Stone Camp has been closed down, the Standing Rock movement is very much alive, and on today's program, we're going to be talking about a new film about Standing Rock called Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock, and we're going to be talking with two out of three of the film's three co-directors. My guests on the show today, I am really happy to say, are director Myron Dewey, whose drone footage and daily live updates from Standing Rock made him one of the most important journalistic voices to come out of this great movement. He is the founder and owner of Digital Smoke Signals, and he himself is a Nui Numa Palute Shoshone from the Walker River Paiute tribe. I hope I am not pronouncing that too terribly, as well as from the Agui Dakota Band, and Myron, you'll have to tell us what that means, and Tomoke Shoshone. In other words, he comes from a very rich and diverse indigenous background. Myron Dewey is a professor, filmmaker, editor, digital storyteller, historical trauma trainer, very relevant to the film and what went down at Standing Rock and to what's going down in our country right now. He's also a drone operator and a journalist, and the goal of Digital Smoke Signals is to help bridge the digital divide throughout Indian country and indigenize media through indigenous eyes while sharing cultural core values of culture, reciprocity, respect, and family. I'm very pleased and honored to welcome Myron to Connect the Dots, as well as our second director, James Spione. He's an Academy Award nominee of a recent film, a previous film that's a whistleblower documentary called Silenced, and he was also nominated for an Emmy Award in 2016. His previous work, Incident in Baghdad, won Best Documentary Short at the Tribeca Film Festival and earned an Oscar nomination. Mr. Spione's other films include American Farm, about the demise of his family's fifth-generation homestead in central New York State. Jim Spione has also written and directed a number of fiction films, including one that was a favorite at Sundance called Garden, starring Oscar winner Melissa Leo. The third director will not be joining us today, but he's someone that I've covered a great deal on Connect the Dots, and that is the filmmaker Josh Fox of Gasland 1, Gasland 2, and How to Let Go and Love the World, a great climate picture. So we're going to be talking with two of the directors today of Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Myron and Jim.
Well, thank you, Allison. That was quite a comprehensive introduction there.
Well, I'm very honored to have you as guest today on the show. And, you know, it's the film which I've seen and previewed and which is going to be showing this coming weekend on Martha's Vineyard at the Environmental Film Festival, and we'll be talking about that more throughout the program. I saw a few weeks back, and, you know, ironically, at first, you know, people might wonder why three directors of the film. Yet when you see the film, it does make sense. But I'm going to put that question to you both to start out today. You know, how did it come about that three of you directed each a different segment to make up this whole film?
I think a lot of that, it was interesting bit of serendipity there, because there wasn't a plan initially going in to do that for any of us. I mean, Myron had been there, and he could tell you this, but for many months, doing his own thing, doing his live updates, doing his short pieces for social media and so forth. Actually, Myron's work was one of the ways that I was finding out about Standing Rock before I even got there. I knew I wanted to do a feature film of some sort. I didn't really have a plan, like a lot of people. I just felt drawn to Standing Rock. I was like, I have to be there. Something really important and profound is going on, something historic. I want to be part of recording this. And then Josh as well, was there. And I was just kind of an intermittent contact with Josh. We had never, worked on anything before. We certainly knew of and supported each other's work. And we were sort of texting back and forth, and at one point, Josh just said, hey, we should work on something together. And from there, it kind of grew. Josh was working with Florice Whitebull on working on a script. I was gathering my footage. Myron had, a lot of stuff, gathered already. And we sort of came up with this plan to, create a collaborative piece which would allow us, not only to have three distinct sort of voices and visions about what was happening at Standing Rock, but also to sort of do something in the spirit of Standing Rock itself, which was such a community inspired event, so collaborative. There wasn't a hierarchy there. There were a lot of people bringing all their talents and what they could do together for this one goal. And then the third reason was that we could go faster. It was very important to Josh to get something out quickly so that we could be part of the ongoing discussion about Standing Rock, so it could be sort of a continuation of the spirit of Standing Rock and sort of pick up where that left off as an activist piece to motivate people to continue the fight. And that was a very long-winded answer, but that's my version of how this all sort of came together. But I'm sure Myron has a perspective as well.
What was it like for you, Myron? You were there. You were on the ground. You were there for the duration. Yours was one of the first, strongest, and most enduring among the sort of spontaneous indigenous coverage that arose from the place, that arose at the time. I mean, what was your hope and dream in capturing this for the place, for the people, for water and the situation that we're all in?
Well, thank you guys for having us here and having me share this story. And the continued story for Indigenous people is that who controls the media controls culture. And I think that if we did not get there, if I did not get there myself and use the tools that I had in digital storytelling, historical trauma training, and educator to share what has already been happening in any country way before Standing Rock started. And our homelands down here in Nevada is one huge reason why I went to Standing Rock is Antarctica is we're called trout eaters, and we've already lost our traditional food source here in our lifetime, and the water source is also contaminated from mining, from special interests, from deforestation, fighting for traditional harvesting areas, And myself and many other relatives that came from around the country and the world to help support the same in their areas. So Standing Rock had a collaboration of some of the most professional people, I think, on the planet that were specializing in their areas, indigenous people, that we've been constantly in defense of our traditional harvesting areas and our sacred sites, and above all, our water. And the goal there was, as I've seen the checking in the media into the thousands of media coming in from journalists, filmmakers, hobbyists, just seeing that there was a lot of Indian 101 having to share with every single media that came through in August, September, and October, was that this narrative is an indigenous-led movement, and that once the narrative changes, it would take away the message of the human rights violations that we were seeing, the civil rights violations that we're seeing with our allies there, and that this was an inherent right that was being violated here, and that this is also on broken treaty land. And so many of the people that I've spoken with that went to Standing Rock didn't realize or didn't know that indigenous people were still around. And so they had to come to see for themselves, to fact check on their own. And it was really, for them, there was a huge calling as well, that spiritual calling. And so myself just educating as much as I could while I was there. If people wanted to interview me, I would bring them out on the line and the front line with me to let them see and document it for themselves. And I did as much as I could to help articulate it, educate our relatives there, when and when not to film during ceremonies, and the permission of the elders and the parents. They were interviewing children. There was so much going on, and it was changing by the hour there. So it's still moving forward. We're still educating, and the piece that I got in there is to really educate the people that the constitutional violations are happening right now with the Morton County Police Department, abusing the law and giving water protectors felonies for their First Amendment rights as American citizens.
Yes, there's just in the last couple of days, there are several people that, you know, where they're hardening into arrests under novel, legal language that has not been in wide use. There's also some expected revelations that there was in the police response to Standing Rock a lot of backstage planning and collusion and by various entities in the American government, even including the Bureau of Indian Affairs and others that, you know, one would naively perhaps think would be on the side of the peoples. So even just as we, you know, for people who think that Standing Rock, was finished when the camps closed down, in fact, it is enduring. There's more to find out about it, and there's a lot more to know and discover about how the tremendous use of military force that occurred there, which is documented in the film Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock, came to happen. Because it is really the use of military force against Americans, against our own people, against people domestically. It's kind of turning a page and going even further. Although that's for white people like myself who are, you know, kind of horrified and bearing witness to this. But what I hear from, you know, my native people and friends that I know is that there's a long history to this, and, you know, we're just beginning. Many of us are just finally paying attention. Myron, one of the things you mentioned was Indian 101, cultural sensitivity. Many liberal Americans or progressives, you know, regard themselves as being caring and literate when it comes to the needs of people who have been on the suppressive and harsh end of what Americans do and dish out, you know, what we do as a country. But still, there can be lack of awareness and lack of sensitivity. How would you feel about doing a little bit of Indian 101 for people so that more people can better understand, you know, what we could be looking at and working on and really realizing about ourselves and the Native peoples in this situation?
Well, when I went to UC Santa Barbara and UC Berkeley and the different universities, University of Washington, mm-hmm. just to remind our relatives, our Native and non-Native, is that ethnohistorians are not the cited source. It's the indigenous cited source where they got their cited source. And when I was getting my master's at the University of Kansas, it wasn't about my work. It became about who I was citing. And it was I was getting my MA from the Indigenous Nations Department, creating my own track in digital language preservation. So even in the academia arena, where that's your hugest source of educating the world through our academia, even though Haskell Indian Nations University was only a mile and a half away from University of Kansas, that's the barrier that seems to be there, is this invisible barrier even in education, as we've seen at North Dakota from Bismarck to Standing Rock. And many of the people who did not get the correct information from the tribe or from local newspapers were getting it from Bismarck Tribune, Fargo Tribune, a few other local newspapers that were not accurately interpreting what was happening. And then the Morton County Police Department was putting out also media that wasn't accurate. And so what we would do in educating both sides of the pipeline was take their video, take their media, and put video to it and show what is happening in real time. This is what's happening down on the ground. And it wasn't easy in the beginning because there are some challenges. The challenges is the yellow journalism that was coming into Standing Rock, having to find that, stepping out of your role as just documenting and being a journalist. And in Indian country, jack of all trades, and a lot of the filmmakers that came to Standing Rock were either just filming, but the allies that were filming were being connected through participating in the ceremony, meeting all the people on the ground, and making sure that they contributed, because there was a lot of self-reliance happening there. If you didn't participate, you weren't as much as a contributor, so you had to be a contributor. And that's part of the educating there, is that you can really see the difference. And we're going to see hundreds of coming out of here, but what you are going to really see is who's always participating in those grassroots, security, cooking, morning meetings, afternoon meetings, evening meetings. There was so much dynamics happening, but also to role model that this was a sustainable community, like sacred stones that had the largest yurt community in the world, role modeling sustainability, community, and can still practice their First Amendment as both Native and non-Native together in unity in prayer, praying in their own way. And that was, I think, one of the most unique times that held us together, is that unity that understood that. So when yellow journalism came in, it didn't have that much of an effect. We had to just really work on the outside media. Or when the FBI came in, or Homeland Security, Border Patrol, or all these different agencies that were coming in, task forces from around the country, educating them also, when I got the time, and asking them who was their cultural advisor in law enforcement, who helped them understand where their environment, because they did not adapt to their environment. And we've seen that with untrained officers, and the result was the violence and the human rights violations. So it's really stepping outside of just documenting in journalism.
Yes, it was really, and it wasn't just advocacy journalism as in talking about and letting people know. It was really grassroots in process in community with journalism because, yeah. You know, you were in, you know, this was a zone of addressing an oncoming crisis, which was the installation of the Dakota Access Pipeline and the and the extremely high risk to total certitude that it would break, that it would leak, that it would contaminate water and contaminate communities. And so that was an imminent threat that everyone had gathered to deal with. One of the things about, so you really had all of that community organizing as well as just being sustainable, you know, at the site to live and manage and contribute and protect both the water and the people who were subject to acts of harm by the police and the military, all of that. You know, what you just said about also about education, one of the things that was so astounding in the film, Awake from, you know, A Dream from Standing Rock, which I hope listeners that you will all take, you know, find the way to see it. It's really a major, important, sea-changing piece of work. But one of the things that is incredible is that you see this, you know, in the film, you see this lineup of these, of military brute force in masks. It's with weapons, standing on high ground, having taken over, actually, the traditional burial grounds of the people, the indigenous people of that region. And it's really one of the most disturbing and horrifying things one could ever see. And yet, in the face of that, and, you know, are people actually, you know, the people at Standing Rock actually praying on behalf of these oppressors and having the courage to both stand right up to them, right near to them, and putting oneself in harm's way. And, you know, in the American culture, it's all about, you know, how can I be happy and how can I be this and how can I be successful? And here are people risking their lives together in community and praying on behalf of the people oppressing them. And I mean, this was so extraordinary, and it's not something that I think comes naturally to a lot of people in this country, or that even people could very easily find a way to do outside of the culture of Standing Rock. And yet that, how do you do that? I mean, that is the most amazing role modeling I've ever seen.
How do you do it? Is role modeling. You have to model what you're projecting. And that was the most important part, is I would tell the crew that was with me, is always we have to role model, take the higher ground no matter what, because we dilute the message if we do otherwise. And and that, you know, one of the things there at Standing Rock was, it was considered one of the most hostile areas in the United States at that time to be doing filmmaking and be a journalist and documenting. And if you were filming, you were targeted, and either by rubber bullet or by pulled out of the crowd. And there's many stories of filmmakers and journalists and photographers getting arrested and getting their equipment taken, and their hard drives and their SIM cards. And this is the role, as you see in the film, you know, mobile media was also, citizen journalism was a really big movement there at Standing Rock.
So by that, there were a lot of people with eyes on and recording so that others could see the situation, so that it wasn't happening in a dark alley where no one could know about it, that the actual multitude of people who had come to bear witness and to capture what was happening made you both a target, and it was also a form of protection for the whole, because the story would be told.
Yes, it could be told accurately. And that comes back to, again, who controls the media controls the culture. And, you know, for the last 100 years of media, 120 years coming up for media with indigenous people in that media, the story has always been inaccurately told, from photography to music to media. And many of the times I've spoken with our allies coming from L.A. and Los Angeles, Hollywood, is to, you have your original speakers, have them help you articulate. Don't try to come in and try to do it for us, because that's not going to help. And you're not here to save us, you know. So you have to figure out, why are you here? Are you here to stop a pipeline? Are you here to document for your own personal business or gain? Or are you really here for the to be a part of this movement and share the story as we've seen, you know, Jim and Josh do.
You know, you could see the Standing Rock really wasn't being even covered that much by the mainstream media. And when it was, you could see that kind of usual frame that Myron's talking about, even with supposedly liberal outlets like the New York Times. The usual framing of the story would be a headline that would lead with X number of protesters arrested at Standing Rock. You know, so the frame is immediately arrests, someone's doing something wrong, law enforcement point of view, and then you would go into the body of the article, and the first six or seven paragraphs would be quotes from Morton County, quotes from law enforcement, this happened, that happened, and then you would have maybe a sprint. I'm just giving you the format. You'd have a sprinkling maybe midway through of one or two water protectors saying something about more like philosophical comments, but not like their version of what happened at all. So the whole thing is so routinely skewed, and that's a cultural bias. It's not someone at the Times going, oh, I'm going to do something that's really going to be on law enforcement side. It's just it's inherent in the structure of how our media is. You know, they do the same thing with our overseas wars. Everything is put through a certain frame. And so, the idea to be there as an independent filmmaker for myself was, well, let me go see for myself what's going on. Let me be part of really telling the true story of what happened here. I just wanted to, comment. You were talking before about, you know, the information coming out about federal agencies and the involvement of different, law enforcement and other agencies in dealing with, so to speak, the Standing Rock resistance. And, you know, that, I wanted to say that that's nothing new. I mean, certainly, as Myron will tell you, certainly in terms of indigenous history, but it's nothing new in America anyway. I mean, the labor rights movement was repressed. And the civil rights movement, you know, the FBI had, you know, files on everyone. They tried to get, you know, Martin Luther King to commit suicide. The environmental movement, was similarly, you know, repressed and investigated as, eco-terrorism. We saw in Ferguson a military response, you know, very similar situation with military gear and police, you know, looking more like soldiers. We saw it in Baltimore with the Freddie Gray protests. Post 9/11 in this country, it was very formalized with these so-called fusion centers, where, you know, state and federal authorities could coordinate with local, authorities to supposedly to combat terrorism. But, you know, I am sure with this, as with these others, any kind of, you know, progressive movement that challenges the reigning structure of things, gets thoroughly investigated and put on the target list. And so I'm sure that was going on at Standing Rock. And in fact, on the last days, particularly on the final day of the action to clear the camps, there was a helicopter from a Border Patrol flying over with a sniper in it. And actually, Myron posted some very clear pictures of that. Anyone could see them if they look for them on Facebook. But, and Border Patrol, you know, what border are we patrolling here? The border between North Dakota and South Dakota? I mean, it doesn't matter. The point was, you know, federal agencies, and state agencies, all of these law enforcement resources were brought to bear, multiple state police organizations, National Guard. I mean, it was just highly coordinated effort, constant surveillance, constant helicopters flying over. I mean, it really felt like a war zone many times. Mm-hmm. And through all of this, you know, the fact that it remained largely peaceful, largely about prayer and ceremony, was really remarkable and inspiring. You know, I was there that, and it's in my section of the film, that night of November 20th, where there was a long altercation on the bridge, at the Backwater Bridge, where there were hundreds of water protectors, and police came down with everything from mace and tear gas to infamously water hoses in this sub-freezing weather. And, you know, as you can see, it's kind of terrifying. I was quite terrified being there, to tell you the truth. There were rubber bullets flying and other forms of crowd dispersal weapons, you know, concussion grenades and these other sorts of devices where that would explode a bunch of plastic pellets to, you know, basically in law enforcement, this is called quote unquote pain compliance. So this was all brought to bear on these people. And yet at the same time, and you can see this in the film too, the atmosphere was almost one of a celebration on the part of the water protectors. They were not going to be deterred. They stood their ground singing songs, you know, in prayer, in unity. This was amazing for me to be, you know, recording this and really a privilege to be able to bring that to the world in this film. As Myron said, I think, you know, there will be lots of Standing Rock films and we'll get lots of perspectives going forward. But I'm just, you know, honored to be part, you know, some small part of recording this incredible event for history.
Mm-hmm. It's incredibly important because it really shows how high the stakes are for our protecting the environment. I mean, we have a very dire situation, and, you know, we have a lot of corporate control and agendas, you know, to derail the ecological, that will derail and are derailing our, the ecological stability of the Earth and our ability to continue residing here. And, you know, and then here arise people protecting the land that their ancestors have long loved and regarded as core to their spiritual values, where, you know, living in a more civilized, from different backgrounds, you know, people's spiritual core can be either, you know, derailed or confused or fragmented or, you know, attached to things that are not earth-centric, you know, all kinds of things that can be going on. And here this, you know, movement of people arises. And that particular night, I mean, I remember when it happened, I was, you know, glued to Facebook watching it and everything. But a lot of people, because of the kind of mainstream media coverage you're talking about, Myron and Jim, you know, weren't actually aware of what was going on there or that it happened. And the film really shows that too and brings it to people. And so I'm just going to, you know, plug the film one more time here, although we're nowhere near the end of our show, but just to say we're talking about Awake, a Dream of Standing Rock. We're talking with two out of three of the directors of that film. It recently was a big hit at the Tribeca Film Festival. It's being shown around the country. In fact, I'd like to maybe ask you all what the current plans are for it. We're all going to be participating at a screening of the film in the Martha's Vineyard Environmental Film Festival this coming weekend, Memorial Day weekend, May 28th at 4 p.m. at the Martha's Vineyard Film Center. And you can also find that online if you're anywhere in the region. I think a lot of water protectors are going to be coming on the ferry to the island in order to see this and participate in other activities with the local tribe, the Wampanoag tribe of the Cape and Northeast region. And so if you're in the vicinity, any listeners, you know, you'd be warmly welcome to come too and both see the wonderful film and participate in other events. But also, because of the privilege of having you both here, I'm mindful that many of our listeners may not be in the region and they may want to know how can they get to see Awake, a Dream of Standing Rock. How is that happening? How is the film being distributed and released around the country?
Well, we had about a month where it was available online for people to pay what they will to stream it for themselves and their communities. That was also a fundraising effort to raise funds for Indigenous media makers and for new water protector initiatives that are springing up around the country. There have been a lot of community screenings. There were, I believe, over 300 community screenings the same day that we premiered at Tribeca. And it'll be playing other film festivals. And then, you know, later on, so there may be a community screening near you. That's something you kind of have to research online. And then later on this year, in a few months' time, it will be widely available. We were not allowed to say yet, but on a major online streaming service. So it will get wide, worldwide exposure and distribution.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to rerun the program at that time when that happens, or bring you back. Yeah, where can people go to look it up?
Awakethefilm.org.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also action plans on what you can do in your community and how you can show your own screening. And I really encourage everyone to watch the film and see what's in your area, see how it pertains to you, because with these and the equipment that Morton County had used, that really opened the door for these police departments to start buying their own equipment. And so there's a Standing Rock coming near you, and this is what we're seeing out there. And to be really aware, I was just watching a short news on railroads, and the railroad guy was talking about he was helping the local military training, and he said, "I'm real patriotic. Feel really good to be able to open up the railroads for them heading to Alaska." And on the vehicle was those sound percussion vehicles that were used at Standing Rock. And I just couldn't believe it. And they were all lined up, and I was thinking, there's nothing but Indigenous people up that way in the line of fire of oil. And so they're really isolated out there. And the digital divide has been my work for many years, bridging the digital divide throughout any country. Standing Rock was an example of what it feels like to be of the digital divide. A community, impoverished community, low-income community that doesn't have the bandwidth or self-services or connectivity that most of America has. And at a most important time in history, this is where you've seen it in the documentary Awake. And so this awakethefilm.org is a place to get information to help you show this and screen it in your community, so you can have a roadmap on what to do in your community and to bring awareness, and not to create fear in any shape or form, but you know, this First Amendment is being challenged in the state of North Dakota right now, as we're seeing 814 water protectors that have been arrested
for exercising their First Amendment rights.
For exercising the First Amendment rights as American U.S. citizens, but also as Indigenous people, the inherent right predating Western content. And what we witnessed was that broken really does say a lot of the relationship from government to government between Indigenous people and the United States. Broken promises.
Mm-hmm.
It really put it out there.
You know, it's such a strange thing, because when this whole thing began with the present administration, with immigrants and everything, from my perspective, everyone in this conversation, with the exception, Myron Dewey, of you, and, you know, everyone in most conversations in most places of the government, are descendants of immigrants. We're all descendants of immigrants. So, you know, why we would want to then call other immigrants non-American and consider ourselves American is historically inaccurate, because, you know, the Native Americans, you're a Native American, the rest of us are all descendants of immigrants. And that's just historical accuracy. And yet, you know, people frame it all different ways to say that they're American and someone else is not. And actually, most of us aren't. And if we were, you know, we would do well to really love and respect the earth that has sustained us for however long our families have been here, and for your families and your relatives for a much, much longer time. You know, we have about, I guess, maybe 12 or so minutes before we close the show. I just have to ask you, Myron, about historical trauma and, you know, how you address it, how you treat it. You know, the United States is every day becoming more and more of a trauma field for nearly everyone. You know, many more people who thought themselves, you know, some kind of safe zone included. And this is something else that that you know about and have not forgotten or, you know, buried the stories. And, you know, although some of them have been lost, I mean, what do we, you know, how do you define historical trauma, and what do we need to understand about it?
So the earlier in November, the churches had come to Standing Rock, and the clergy, and there was around 550 total, and from around the United States and around the world of religious groups. And they came and denounced the doctrine of discovery. And that is the building of the acceptance of genocide is the doctrine of discovery here, killing in the name of God. And they acknowledged the loss of land. They acknowledged the forced religion. They've acknowledged and apologized for the sexual abuse, the child molestation, and generations that have happened in the, not just the churches, but in the boarding schools put out by the federal government. They apologized for the forced loss of language, the beating for speaking your language and only speaking English, or forced to speak English. And you can imagine that being at a young age, you know, the kidnapping of our children from the reservations in the early days, where they would come through in wagons and just take children right from where they were at. They were playing, and they wouldn't tell the parents where they were going, up to 1,000 miles away. Places like Haskell Indian Nations University was a boarding school, Stewart Boarding School down here, Chimawa, different boarding schools around our country that they would take them to. And to that is part of the healing that I got as a trainer, to witness that and interview them and hear that from many of the different preachers, the women and the men that have shared their story of how no longer can they stand there and tell their members and push it into the background that these atrocities had happened, and the foundation of the country built on the atrocities. But also the military came in, and different branches came in and apologized to the indigenous people, which is also part of the historical trauma, which is they apologized for the loss of land, for the forced militarization on their homelands, on our homeland, traditional sites, for the desecration of burial grounds. And it was so in detail that it really is it needs to be told by our allies. It needs to be told, that story, on how do we heal from this. Because once that is understood from both parts, the healing begins. And not everyone is at that level of healing. So even checking in the media into the thousands, it became apparent that there were certain ones that weren't ready for that healing. They weren't ready for the indigenous history, or the other side of the American dream was the American Holocaust. And it was heavy for our allies. It was heavy for our visitors. And just to see and hear those things was really hard for our allies to come through and say, what do we do now? How do I go home and share this with my family that Thanksgiving was a massacre? Or how do I go home and share these stories of what I'm seeing here, Standing Rock on the Bridge, or the North Treaty, a broken treaties? How do I take that back to school? And these were the solutions that we were sharing, is you can do it in a good way. You can say, okay, here's how we're healing from this. And the hard part about, I think, the indigenous people there at Standing Rock and that were came to visit from North America, South America, and all throughout Turtle Island was that the oppression and genocide has been so apparent that we're almost like watching a movie that we've been desensitized from, that our nine-year-olds watch.
Mm-hmm.
We're desensitized from the violence on the movie, and we went through it so long, we just kind of like, when I seen our allies crying about what happened, and you have our own people, indigenous people, kind of happy that they're getting arrested and they're going to jail for what they believe in. It was, I could see we were desensitized from that because it happened so many times from a young age of being racially profiled. You know, walking in a store profiled, police profiled, our teens are profiled, the juvenile system is, you're profiled in there. And also our children that are taken from their parents and put into the foster care system, the state system, where they steal our children and they profit off of our children in the state process of criminal and parenting and also education. So this is something that they got to see in a whole circumference, like, wow, how can you stay out of poverty when all the odds are against you? And you can still smile and stand and pray and say, I forgive you.
Yeah. How can you do that? How are your relatives and you able to do that? I mean, it's so incredible. Like a privileged white American from the background that I come from, for example, we'd be in psychotherapy for 100 years, you know, trying to cope with, you know, something. I mean,
yeah. It's pretty simple. It's we're connected to our food store still, our songs and our ceremonies. And
mm-hmm.
I think when our allies came also, they got to hear we got to hear their teachings and we got to hear different cultural teachings, but it was really being connected spiritually to your core foundation. And
mm-hmm.
when the sacred fire was going, it's you got basic needs of warmth and water and shelter together, the community healed together. And for us, it's that ceremony and connection to Mother Earth. It's just our way of life. It's not really going to pray, but it's our way of life. And
you know, it's so important. I didn't mean to interrupt, Myron, but just hearing your words, you know, that this is an indigenous-led movement. You know, what Myron, I hear him saying is it's sort of like they're not inventing something new. It's
mm-hmm.
that's why they know what to do. You're saying, well, how do they know what to do? It's because they already are connected to what to do. It's we in the larger colonial society that have become
mm-hmm.
disconnected. And that's the
right.
sort of revelation that I think a lot of us had going to Standing Rock and seeing this way in action. You know, I can't tell you, you know, you were saying earlier about, you know, people not being really aware of what was going on at Standing Rock. And they're still not aware. I screened this film a couple nights ago for my local community here in Upper Westchester of New York State, Westchester County, you know, not far from the city, very kind of a privileged, very white area. And the people in the audience were absolutely blown away. They just literally said afterward, I had no idea that this could happen in the United States. I had no idea. And, you know, it's sort of by design. It's all that news and propaganda that we're fed from birth to be in denial about this. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you had no idea. It's never stopped, you know, and this is going on. And, you
yeah.
know, talk about historical trauma. It's not just indigenous people. I mean, the black community has its own
mm-hmm.
historical trauma, obviously, from slavery and from oppression that goes on to this day.
Mm-hmm.
I did want to say something, my own experience, and this just happened last night. And I guess it was kind of goes to the point of what Myron was talking about, you know, other traditions and the things that maybe we have in common. I was at a choral concert last night, my son's high school. And they did a tune called "The Eyes of All Wait Upon Thee," which is a Christian hymn from Psalms, I believe. And the quote is, "The eyes of all wait upon thee, and thou givest them their meat in due season. Thou openest thine hand and satisfiest the desire of every living thing." And when I heard them sing this, my thought immediately was, that's talking about water. Satisfies the desire of every living thing. And in fact, if you think about it, if water is needed for all life, and it is, then God is water. And so we have this conception in Western culture of God is over there or up in the sky or something else. Or in the indigenous culture, and I don't want to speak for Myron and his traditions, but it is in everything. And if we think in the Western tradition, oh, God breathes life into everything, but really maybe it's simpler than that. And it's water that we're talking about. And so, you know, every time we desecrate the earth, every time we poison the water, every time we treat the earth like a source of money and as something to extract and exploit, we're hurting all life in a sense. We're hurting ourselves. Mm-hmm. That was just sort of a little epiphany I had last night. But that's how Standing Rock kind of changes you. You start to hear things and see things differently. And so hopefully people seeing the film come away with a little bit of an understanding of Standing Rock and hopefully see things differently as well.
I mean, that really says it. That's why everyone has to see this film. Thank you so much to both of you. You know, Myron Dewey and Jim Spione, you've been so articulate and deeply sharing of the wisdom and the Standing Rock experience and why that's something for all of us to connect with and cherish and support in various ways through seeing the film that you have directed along with Josh Fox, Awake a Dream. I always screw that up. Is it Awake a Dream of Standing Rock or From Standing Rock? Awake a Dream from Standing Rock. And it's really actually a very precious opportunity as someone whose focus and attention and heart was there, was in a situation where I couldn't travel there. Many of my friends and colleagues of many years did. But it really satisfies that thirst for life, for water, for community, for a group of people who can act together out of connection and act effectively to protect what we hold dear, you know, and to know what that is. And it really, the film Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock, takes you right into that experience. And I've been also feeling it talking with you both this hour. Great privilege for you to come on the show. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having us on. I'm really excited about coming to Martha's Vineyard. I'm very psyched about seeing my friend Myron again and just being there and hopefully, you know, talking with your local indigenous people there. I really am interested in what they have to say about their experiences, about what they think of this film. So I'm looking forward to all of that this weekend.
Yes.
And anyone in the region, please do come. It's not to be missed, really. MV Film Center, May 28th, 4 p.m. And everyone, though, should go to the website and make sure to see this film. Myron, your final words for our listeners?
Yes, I just want to say thank you, everyone, for your solidarity, sharing the message, and educating yourself on what did happen at Standing Rock. Many people showed up from watching the live feeds, and I want to thank all the water protectors for putting themselves out there like that to be able to share the story. And keep your prayers currently for the 814 water protectors that are going to court in 2 days. Prolific is going to court, Sean, for a pending 7 years of documenting with his drone. And these type of charges, fabricated out there. And so this is where we're going to go up and film and just keep in prayer that the right decisions are being made there and that we can continue collectively protecting the water and the sacred.
And Myron, thank you, Myron, for all the work that you're doing and continue to do to educate, you know, all of us out here
mm-hmm.
about what's going
yeah.
on. And really, you're really an inspiration. So I just want to say that to you, buddy.
Oh, appreciate that. Oh, thank you, guys.
Oh.
All right. Thank you. Oh, and thank you, listeners, for being with us on this very special edition of Connect the Dots. You know, there's an open mic here for you all at any time, just for you to know. Welcome back at any time to use this platform. Really mean that. You know, be honored to help that in any way. And also, you know, go on to Facebook. Look for Digital Smoke Signals. Look for James Bion. Follow their work. You can do that too. And look for Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock. Thank you for being with us on today's show. And we'll be with you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy.
Well, who will? Who will? Who will? Who will?